Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times food columnist and author Mark Bittman, a.k.a. the Minimalist, likes food. Maybe too much. 2 years ago, he had high cholesterol, high blood sugar, sleep apnea, and 35 extra pounds. He made changes to his own diet and to the recipes he shares. Earth-friendly changes. The icing on the cake, he says, the soy on the tofu, is that while you're dropping pounds, you can also save the planet. And need to. This hour, On Point food writer and philosopher, Mark Bittman. You can join the conversation. Is Mark Bittman already your go-to guy for recipes, for food advice? Are you ready to follow him onto earth-friendly terrain at the table? Joining me now from New York is Mark Bittman. He writes the weekly New York Times column, The Minimalist and The Bitten blog. He's author of the best-selling cookbook, How to Cook Everything, which is just out with a 10th anniversary edition. His new book is Food Matters, A Guide to Conscious Eating. We have recipes at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark Bittman, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
This is really a terrific read. You've got a big view of what the world, the earth in here, and also a big view of eating, and you say that it began with your own health. Describe for us what got your attention, Mark.
Well, there were sort of external and internal factors that got my attention. I think one was about 5 years ago, it became clear, even to me, that we Americans could really not continue to eat the way we had been for the last, since World War II, that this sort of meat-centric, processed food-centric diet was doing nobody any good. So I registered that. I didn't do much about it, but I thought I became more vegetable friendly, shall we say,
right.
But I didn't. And then about 2 or 3 years ago, a couple things happened at the same time. One was that there was a UN report called Livestock's Long Shadow, which revealed the fact that about 18% of all greenhouse gases are generated by industrial livestock production. And this was actually these numbers were just backed up by a piece in this month's Scientific American. Mm-hmm. So they remain pretty much authentic, solid numbers. And that means close to a fifth of all the gases that cause global warming come from eating meat, indirectly or
directly.
That's
a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot. Actually happens to be second after only energy production.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing was, as I went to my long-term doctor, and he said, you know, you've been doing really well. I'm turning 59 this month, mm-hmm. So I was about 57. He said, you've been doing really well, but your cholesterol's up, your blood sugar's up, you're complaining of sleep apnea, you look a little fat, you need knee surgery because you keep running, but your knees can't carry the weight.
Right.
He said, you know, you really ought to become a vegan. So I laughed and said, you know, I write about food for a living. It's
right.
Not going to be
How
easy.
Can I do that? Yeah.
And he said, figure something out. You're a smart guy. Figure something out. So I looked at all of this stuff. I weighed all of these things. The fact that I was really, in a way, disgusted with industrial meat production. I was not enchanted with the way we Americans rely on super processed food. I had these personal health problems. I saw this global warming stuff, and I thought there has to be a way that sort of ties all this together and makes sense. And I came up with what for me works, and I want to start right here by saying that I'm not suggesting that other people do precisely this, but that this is one model of a way of eating that of which there are several others that will work equally well. But mine is, I'm very strict about the way I eat between the time I wake up and the time I eat dinner, and I eat only fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, and, that's really it, nuts, dried fruits, things like that. And I actually wind up eating a lot of raw food because it's hard to kind of cook for yourself during the day, and it's hard to buy that kind of food in restaurants and in cafeterias. But if I see roast vegetables, I eat them. I eat salads and so on down the line. And then at night, I do pretty much whatever I want to do, which is eat my normal Well, I ate Super Bowl food last night. Actually, I had shrimp, shrimp cocktail followed by hot dogs, if you believe that. But so that's the truth.
So it's a person,
I wouldn't make that up.
Right. It's a personal recipe in a way, but it's also political or global. I mean, you're saying if people could do something like this, the impact for the environment globally could be enormous.
Well, there, you look at it from a personal perspective and you look at it from a global or bigger perspective, and it can only be positive. And these things are pretty much inarguable. I mean, meat is clearly tied to high cholesterol, which is a marker for something. Seems to be a marker for at least heart disease. Meat is tied to colon cancer. It's tied to high blood pressure to some extent, atherosclerosis, and a bunch of other things. Processed foods with all their sugar and high fructose corn syrup and super highly processed carbohydrates seem to lead to obesity and in turn to diabetes, both of which are really epidemic in this country at this point. So you have this kind of – oh, and so my personal story, just to follow that thread for a second, I did lose 35 – in a couple of months, actually, I lost 35 pounds. My blood sugar went back into the normal range. My cholesterol went back into the normal range. My sleep apnea went away.
No more snoring and waking up in the night.
Mm-hmm. None. And now I just sleep the bad sleep of an old man, but it's a different kind of bad sleep.
Lucky you.
Actually, I'm running again with much better knees. So all of that stuff did get better. But then if you look at the fact that 50% of all corn and soy in this country is raised to feed animals, and of which there are 10 billion slaughtered annually in the United States, and you look at the fact that those crops are raised in monoculture with tons of chemical fertilizer, which kills the Gulf of Mexico, which if those crops happen to be fed instead of to animals, if they happen to be fed to starving people around the world, there would be no more starvation problem. If those animals were not giving off the greenhouse gases they're giving off, then global warming would be slowed. It certainly wouldn't be turned around. I mean, I'm not Pollyannish about this, but there would be an impact. And you know, the fact that now they're finding antibiotics in the soil because so many, and 50% of all antibiotics are prescribed to animals in the United States. So even if you wanted to try to avoid hormones and antibiotics by consuming animals directly, it's hard to avoid them consuming those things indirectly. So there's just a laundry list of negative impacts of eating a diet that is 80, 70, 80, 90% by calorie, highly processed food, meat, and other animal products, and only 10 or 20% by calorie, plain, simple, good old fruits and vegetables.
So there's the public and the personal here, and we will look at the formula that you've come up with. It's working for you at a personal health level and maybe also for the planet. I have to say I was astounded by one of the lists you have in here. It's a fascinating book. The Globe and Mail in Toronto calls it part diet plan, part lifestyle manifesto, part cookbook. But you've got a list of the top 10 foods contributing to energy intake calories in the U.S. population. The top 10. And just to look at the top five, you've got number one, by a long shot, our number one source of energy is soft drinks, calories from soft drinks. Number two, cake. Number three, hamburgers, cheeseburgers. Number four, pizza. Number five, potato chips. And you would think it would start to get healthy then, but 6 through 10 are rice, rolls, cheese, beer, and french fries.
French fries being the only vegetable on the list, if you can.
you got a tall mountain to climb with this new view, Mark. A lot of people to persuade.
Well, it's true. The fact that 7% and this list, which I actually start when I go to talks now, when I give talks about food matters, I say I'm going to do a reading, which is sort of a joke because it's really – I mean, it is – there certainly is prose in here, but I don't really do readings well, I guess. But so I read this chart, and it starts with 7% of all the calories Americans – the biggest single source of calories for Americans is soda at 7%, which is
Pepsi,
just
Diet
phenomenal.
Pepper, Mountain Dew, right on
down. None of that is diet soda, by the way, which has zero calories.
Right.
So it's all high fructose corn syrup. Which has been villainized by plenty of people and justifiably, but I don't see that much has changed as a result of that. And I think that I think that it's one thing to guilt trip people. I mean, I could go on about all the environmental damage that raising corn and soy and feeding it to animals does. But I think that if you tie that together with a personal benefit, because one could argue that we are quite selfish when it comes down to that, but also to the fact that we're not entirely selfish and that people do want to do something about global warming. I honestly believe that. And here's a little thing that they can do. And I think many people, increasing people, are fed up, and I use the word disgusted before, and it's not too strong a word, about the way we treat animals. And there's something we can do about that. It doesn't mean you become a vegetarian, but if we kill 9 billion animals instead of 10 billion animals a year, that is not a panacea, but that is a billion fewer animals, which is still a pretty big number.
And you think people can do it in spite of how far that list suggests Americans are away from this formula now?
Well, you know, as I said before, the way I chose to go about this, and I have we all have our quirks and we are individuals. And for me, I like to make rules that I can stick with and that are easy to follow. But other people are more flexible and can do things like, you know, skip the pizza. When you think pizza, then a couple times a week have a salad. When you think cheeseburger, have rice and beans. When you think bacon and eggs, have oatmeal. And if those things are done, if those things are done routinely, that is gradually, incrementally, without any kind of drastic behavior. I mean, if you substitute one salad for one cheeseburger, that is a victory. And this kind of incrementalism or whatever, sometimes I call it less meatarianism, but this kind of just very gradual shifting of habits can, over a long period of time, really have a tremendous effect.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about saving our health, our waistlines, and maybe the planet with Mark Bittman, celebrated home cook and food writer, now out to save the world, at least a little bit. His new book is Food Matters, A Guide to Conscious Eating. You may know him from his best-selling cookbook, How to Cook Everything. He's food columnist for the New York Times, has a weekly column, The Minimalist, there, and the Bitten blog. You can see all kinds of stuff there. Let's listen for just a second. Here's Mark Bittman with his message of healthy eating on video, a taste from the New York Times website.
Today we are going where only the bold dare venture. Whole grain pancakes that you actually want to eat. Stay with me. It's all going to happen very fast.
Very fast. Keep your eyes open. Here he is on the PBS show On the Road. Mark Bittman traveling through Spain. Pretty nice. On a culinary cultural tour with Gwyneth Paltrow, Spanish actress Claudia Bassols, and superstar chef celebrity Mario Batali. At times it sounds like reality TV. Here's Mark Bittman unplugged.
I'm so happy back here. I could go the whole trip in the backseat of this car.
You know what?
With the sun, with the sky.
I know.
Just gotta say. When did you see me depressed?
Yes, that sounds pretty good. Who wouldn't want to be there? Now he's got a formula for you. We've got recipes at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join the conversation. Let's go to Hank in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hank, you're on the air.
Hi. It's great to speak with both of you, and I just want to say to Mark that, you know, I really have a lot of admiration for your philosophy about food and how it really kind of bridges the extreme between, you know, the unhealthy traditional American chicken fried steak and Cheetos and the more sort of hippie vegan wheatgrass and quinoa and all that kind of stuff. So I really appreciate how your philosophy and what you do.
Well, thank you. Maybe I'm becoming a hippie vegan because I now think quinoa is fantastic stuff. But I was in Portland a couple of weeks ago on book tour and managed to alienate about half the city by disparaging the widespread use of hemp milk. But yeah, there is sort of a fine line here because on the other hand, one does want to eat chicken fried steak every now and then also, doesn't one? So But that's the whole point of this thing is that I'm not saying I'm certainly not saying become a vegetarian because there's a very strong argument to be made that being a vegetarian makes no more sense than being an omnivore. But I'm not saying become a vegan either, because it's a very challenging and untraditional, and I wouldn't say unnatural. There's nothing unnatural about it, but it's something that's going to be very, very far from the way most of us feel and think about food. So all I'm saying is try to shift that balance between plants on the one hand and everything else on the other hand, because most of the everything else you can do without, and the plants are what make you healthy and what have the lowest environmental impact.
And what's your argument that being a vegetarian makes no more sense than being an omnivore? Lay that out for us.
If you are going to sub... First of all, the term vegetarian does not mean... is not synonymous with the term healthy eater. You could eat Hershey's bars all day long and mm-hmm. call yourself a vegetarian. So you have to define what a vegetarian is, first of all. But second of all, if you substitute a half a pound of dairy, Americans eat on average a half a pound of meat a day. If you substitute a half a pound of dairy or eggs for that half a pound of meat, you haven't done yourself any favors because the impact on your body is about the same. You haven't done animals any favors because dairy animals are tortured just as much as meat animals are. And the environmental impact doesn't change that much either. So, you know, if you're looking for a healthy diet, the thing to substitute is not dairy for meat. The things to substitute is plants for anything else that isn't plants, whether that's animal products or Cheetos or white bread or pasta for that matter. If you can instead of any of those things eat beans or lettuce or dried fruit or fresh fruit or whole grains or nuts or almost any of those things, it's really just two sides. And I'm not saying eliminate one side. I'm saying if you imagine a seesaw or a scales of justice, the heavy side for almost every American, except for dedicated vegans, almost every American has animal products, processed food, and downright junk on the heavy side and plants on the light side. And to the extent that can be shifted and the light side can be made heavy and the heavy side light, that is beneficial to everyone. And, you know, I it always feels sort of corny to say it, but even to the earth, it's true.
You come at that with such interesting kind of tiptoeing, though in the end, your conclusions are pretty strong on that. You write that maintaining the status quo is insane.
Yeah, well, the way we eat does not make sense. And let's remember that the processed foods that we eat did not exist 100 years ago. And the availability of meat and the widespread cheap availability of meat, dairy, other animal products also did not exist until really mid-20th century, and still doesn't exist for most of the world. Now, there are some real parallels to oil here in that meat and animal products have been, up until now, a limited and a scarce resource. They're being produced more and more widespread around the world in industrial fashion as third world, developing world countries have more money and have developed a bigger taste for meat and other animal products. So, but there's a very, just like oil, there's a very, very finite amount of this stuff we can produce. And if we're at peak oil, we're probably also at peak animal products, because right now we are slaughtering, eating 60 billion, that's with a B, animal products worldwide.
60 billion animals slaughtered.
Yeah, 60 billion animals worldwide. And I got confused because I was getting ahead of
myself.
I think
that's right. It's kind of astounding if I remember from the book.
No, 60 billion animals, 10 billion of which, by the way, are consumed in the United States. So 1/6 of all animals go to us, just like about 1/5 or 1/6 of all energy goes to us. But how bad we are is not really the issue here. I mean, we know that America has consumed more than its fair share of many things, and I think that that's going to be taken care of. But that 60 billion worldwide number is projected to grow to 120 billion by 2050. And I think the newer numbers will show that it's going to grow at the rate that it's growing now. It'll be more like 2030 or 2040.
Planet slaughterhouse.
But it's impossible for us to produce that much meat because There's no more efficient, I'm not saying it's not cruel or horrible, but it is efficient. There's no more efficient method of producing meat than the one we're doing now. And we're already using 70% of the available land. 70% of the world's farmland is directly or indirectly involved in producing meat. So there is no, you can double 60 billion to 120 billion theoretically, but as everybody who's taken any math knows, there's no 140% of the Earth's surface. It doesn't exist. So unless we figure out a way to use the moon or sub or aquatic agriculture, it's just not going to happen.
No so moon ranching gotta, option out there, at least not yet. Mark, let me get another call here from Margaret in Dummerston, Vermont. Margaret, you're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Bittman makes so much sense. Thank you. Thank you. This is how we all should eat and live our lives. But I also hope that you can gently convince your friend, Mr. Batali, to read your book.
Mario Batali, why, Margaret?
Because I think Mr. Batali needs to lose a bit of weight.
We'll send Mr. Batali.
I watched some of the program on PBS, and I kept thinking to myself, yes, this food in Spain must be very good, but Mr. Batali, don't eat so much.
Okay, what's the word to your buddy, Mark?
We're going to send Mario a clip of this particular portion of the show. But actually, I watched Mario change the way he ate. I did talk with him about this stuff, mm-hmm. and I didn't say, look, you're overweight. I said, this is how I'm eating because I'm overweight. And I watched him change, and the last time I saw him, he really had lost a lot of weight. And I spoke to him last week, and he said he did love Food Matters. He was really – he'd read the book, and he did love it, and he was changing the way he eats. So we'll see. I have a date with him next week. We'll see if he's turned into like a skinny dude. We'll know. I'll report back.
Okay. We'll see, no doubt, somewhere soon enough. To begin to take us into how this actually works. I mean, you've got a lot of people out there who are going to think, you know, their sort of menu to dinner time, and we'll look at that, but is, I don't know, you know, cereal or pour out some granola or even bacon and eggs or toast, something, yogurt in the morning, ham sandwich, something for lunch, and then on through the rest of the day. But you're saying vegan till 6 or something like that. You know how people think about food, the kinds of things they can and do put on the table. What does this actually look like in terms of what you're eating for breakfast, for lunch, during the day?
You know, I can say what it looks like for me, but let me say this first. If we ate the equivalent, if we all ate the equivalent of 3 fewer cheeseburgers a week, and the cheeseburger is an equivalency. I don't know what a cheeseburger equivalency is precisely, okay. But let's say it's a small meal of meat, so maybe mm-hmm. a bacon and egg breakfast obviously, a cheeseburger, a slice of pizza, a small steak, a chicken breast. These are all sort of roughly equivalent. If we ate 3 fewer servings of that kind of stuff per person per week, it would be the equivalent of taking all the SUVs in the United States off the road. So,
are you sure?
I am sure.
Unlikely, but I'm sure you've done the math or somebody.
A guy in Great Barrington named Gidon Eshel has done the math, and he's a mathematician, and this is for real. So
I can hear people saying, oh, great, saying, three cheeseburgers off the table, and I can still drive my SUV.
Well, I suppose that's one way of looking at it. So I'm just saying three meals a week. What I'm saying is, change 3 meals a week, mm-hmm. which is what, 1/10 of your meals, but probably less than 1/10 of what you actually eat, because we all eat more than just 3 meals mm-hmm. a day. But change 3 meals a week from meat-centric meals, or say animal product-centric meals, to vegan-type meals, and you have an enormous impact. Now, so what's 3 meals? So that means one oatmeal instead of bacon and eggs. That means one fruit salad instead of a sandwich at lunch. That means one rice and beans instead of steak at dinner or whatever. But 3 times a week, which is really once every other day, substitute some kind of plant-based meal for some kind of animal-based meal, and you have a tremendous impact on the planet.
So that's the beginning, but that's not going to get you the full Mark Bittman Food Matters effect here, the 35 pounds gone, the sort of change of life that you describe in the book, Mark.
Well, here's what my days look like. This I had, and again, I'm deeply involved with cooking and with food, and have been for 30 or 40 years. So mm-hmm. I have long explored the food of other cultures, and mm-hmm. remember being excited beyond belief the first time I was in Thailand and was served a stew of rice and fish heads and sausages and scallions and strong flavored foods of all kinds for breakfast, because I really like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to eat strong flavored food in the morning. So I'm perhaps not the prime example of how other people should eat. But I would say that many of my days begin with leftover vegetables from the night before or some kind of whole grain cereal. And it's kind of as simple as that. And then my lunches are almost always roasted vegetables or salads or, again, whole grains with beans, sort of whatever I can scrounge up. And then in the morning and in the afternoon when I'm hungry, since there's no way I could convince anybody that eating this way is quite as satisfying as having bacon and eggs and toast for breakfast, I eat a lot of nuts. I eat a lot of dried fruit. I eat a lot of fresh fruit. Sometimes I have popcorn in the afternoon. And that all sort of gets me to dinner where, as I said, I pretty much do what I want to do. And so that, even that, in describing it, does it sound to you that onerous? It doesn't sound that awful, right?
It sounds no doubt like a way to health, but at the same time, a pretty big step away from people's habits. I mean, I don't think a lot of people wake up to leftover veggies. They could, and it may be well worth it. Let's go to Stacy in St. Mary's, Georgia. Stacy, you're on the air.
Hi, how are y'all?
Very well. What do you know, Stacy?
Well, I was calling because I've done the same thing that Mr. Bittman's done, and I grew up in South Georgia, and fast food and then whole country food with gravy on everything.
Right.
And about 3 years ago, I decided to make a life change with my eating habits, and I'm not a vegetarian either, but I try to eat fresh and eat a lot of fruits and vegetables like he's been doing. And it's gotten to the point now where that once every 6 months where I do have a cheeseburger and I'm on the road, I feel terrible. I mean, absolutely terrible and wasted for the rest of the day.
And what about the rest of the time? Do you feel better, better,
yeah,
way better?
I lost 40 pounds in the past 3 years.
Wow.
I'm now in good shape. I'm only 29 years old, so there was really no sense in being that heavy. But I just, you know, I crave a cheeseburger, go get a cheeseburger, pizza, whatever, like he was saying. And now I normally cook. I try to cook every meal. If we don't cook when we go out, we don't eat fast food. We try to go somewhere where we can get a good salad. But I just think it's so important what Mr. Bittman's talking about, because it's really, really, really so unhealthy, you know, the way that we're eating. And you keep seeing these changes. Even I think Dunkin' Donuts has got the better
flatbreads
and everything. Yeah.
Stacy, we've got it. We've got a break coming up here. Mark, let me ask you, do you have that, not only have I lost weight, but I feel a lot better result from this path?
I feel fine. I felt fine before. I feel fine now. I think I do feel a little bit better. But part of it is also that I have this nice, smug, self-righteous feeling because I know that I'm I know that I'm being a good guy, which is really not that terrible a thing to feel. So I could comment on that, but if you have a break, I could.
No, we've got a minute. I mean,
okay. I just want to say that when I went on book tour for Food Matters, met so many people who said, "Oh yeah, I'm already doing this," and that of course. I mean, I never claimed to have invented anything. I just figured something out that other people had figured out and wrote about it. But the other thing is, the fast food places know that this is the direction to go. They just move very, very slowly, and the more people demand better food out of the fast food joints, the more quickly that's going to happen.
Of course, last night at the Super Bowl, we saw the Cheetos, Doritos, Pepsi ads pretty prompt. The message is still large on the other side of this equation, too.
Yeah, didn't see any lettuce ads, did you?
Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about saving our health, our waistlines, and the planet with Mark Bittman, celebrated home cook and food writer, now out to save the world, at least a little. He joins us from New York. His new book is Food Matters, A Guide to Conscious Eating. There's some controversial stuff in here, maybe, and we'll look at it. Let's go first to Paul in Cabot, Vermont. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've farmed all my life, and my wife and I have been organic since 95, We do dairy and beef.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to point out, I'm glad to hear you're talking about industrialized beef production. I do believe that is harmful. I'd also like to point out that the alternative is a pasture-based beef. And as long as there's dairy of any form, there's also going to be beef.
Sure.
Dairy cows at the end of their usable life become beef,
mm-hmm.
as do the bull calves that they mm-hmm. produce in the process of being milk cows. And also, even vegetable growers need to realize that animal manure is a vital ingredient in vegetable production for fertility. So
sure.
it's really all one big integral system, so you can't really just whack out the whole livestock side.
Paul, if you would hold the thought for a second,
sure.
Paul, because this gets into exactly some of what I think may sound a little controversial to some of those who might most naturally be drawn to what Mark Bittman's saying. Mark, you say, first of all, you say, I don't believe eating organic is essential to sane eating, and you also aren't that high on grass-fed beef. So what do you make of Paul's perspective in Dairy Country, Vermont?
Well, Paul's perspective is actually perfectly right on, I think. What I don't believe is people who say, we can convert all of our livestock production to grass-fed and then or pasture-raised, and then we won't have any problems. Well, we can do that as long as we cut the amount by like 90%.
Because there's not enough pasture in the world.
There's not enough pasture. There's not enough dedicated people to be raised to be talking about the kind of lovely system that Paul's talking about, which does make perfect sense. And if we want to get to a place where our food is more regional, which most of us do, if we want to get to a place where our food is organic or at least close to organic, which most of us do, and I have no arguments with either of those things, but they have to follow or at least happen along with a marked decrease in meat and dairy consumption in the United States. So I don't know what the numbers are going to look like, and neither does anyone else. But my real guess is that if we're producing and slaughtering 10 billion animals right now for consumption, that it's probably going to be more like 1 or 2 billion animals
in this country.
That makes sense in this country. So at that point, we can be at a place where maybe a lot of it is locally raised, grass-fed, pasture-raised, and so on, and maybe a lot of it is organic. But you cannot, as I said before, the methods for raising animals and for producing dairy right now are horrible, but they're also very, very efficient. You can't have that kind of efficiency when you're going to be nice to animals, when you're going to raise them in pastures, when you're going to raise them on organic food and have the nice cycle of their manure feeding the vegetables that then in turn feed people and feed the animals.
Right.
That can only work on a relative. What we're on now is such a monstrous scale that any other scale seems small. But in fact, the small scale would be the normal, the desirable scale.
And what about the organic side of this? Paul says he's been organic since 95. What do you mean when you write, I don't believe eating organic is essential to sane eating?
Well, I think that it's the same as me saying I don't believe that eating the best possible ingredients is essential to sane eating. If you have a choice between an organic head of broccoli and a head of broccoli that's been shipped from Peru, grown conventionally, that's fine. But it's not quite as simple as that, because some organic food is shipped from China at this point, and the exports from China of organic food are growing daily. Some so-called organic milk and other dairy products sold in the United States actually are reconstituted milk powder shipped from New Zealand. Now, that may be organic milk powder, but is that really how you want to be drinking milk? So it's just a very, very complicated series of questions. But I think in order to make it simple, what I'm trying to say is the choice is really not between non-organic and organic. The choice is really between plants and everything else. And that's the first choice you make. Then if you want to worry about whether it's organic or not, that's fine. But first, get the consumption of processed foods and meat and dairy down, and then we can worry more about organic.
Paul, on your organic dairy farm in Vermont, thank you very much for calling. Let's get a call from Waltham, Massachusetts, and Sue. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark.
I'm resisting the impulse to gush over all things Bittman, but I'm a 61 I'm a 61-year-old who had a gastric bypass 5 years ago.
Okay.
I've lost and kept off 80 pounds, and I'm working out 3 days a week at the Y. But my question is really about fish. While I suspect Bittman would really like to have an all raw oyster diet, sounds yummy to me, I'm wondering if he's eating fish, what other fish is he eating and how frequently?
Yeah, fish is actually – the organic question is a tricky question. Fish is the trickiest question because it would be easy to say augment all of your wonderful new plant-based diet with fish and you'll be even healthier. But there are two problems here. One is that farm-raised fish is – this is a bit of an overstatement, but not much. Farm-raised fish is not much more desirable than farm-raised chicken from the perspective of either your health or the environment. So I'm kind of down on aquaculture in general. There's some traditional forms like oysters are okay, but the salmon thing has gone way too far. But wild fish, which is obviously – or not obviously – which is remains a very desirable, the most desirable of all animal products to eat from a health perspective – is so threatened and so endangered globally that it's hard to say to people, eat plants and fish, which would be a kind of chosen, perfect, enjoyable, wonderful diet. Because if everybody did that, there wouldn't be enough fish to go around.
So what's your answer?
Well, my answer is eat fish, but very, very moderately. But don't think that fish can be a staple in your diet, because if everybody did that, then there'd just be no more fish in the sea. And there is a further refinement of that statement, which is that if you want to eat fish that's not so endangered, that appears to remain plentiful, then you have to think about eating fish like sardines and mackerel and anchovies and other fish that are relatively low on – actually fish that are vegetarians as opposed to fish that eat other fish, because – there are many more of them, and they seem to be able to sustain – their numbers seem to be able to be sustained at much, much higher levels than fish like tuna and swordfish and cod and all the other carnivorous fish that we like to eat so much.
Some pretty careful fishing advice there. Sue, thanks for your call. Let's go to Laura in Acton, Massachusetts. Laura, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark. Just an aside, I wanted to say, Mark, you are a rock star in my house, because everything that I cook for my kids that they like to eat comes from your cookbook. So we're big, big fans.
Well, thanks. Nice to hear.
And I really just had a question for you there. You know, of course, so much of what you say makes great sense, and it's wonderful to hear from you, given your history as a wonderful person with food altogether. But I did have a question for you. There's an item in the news recently about one possible side effect of the economic downturn is going to be higher rates of obesity and you know, worse health, because the cheaper foods, these highly processed foods, are, you know, in fact, the ones we all shouldn't be eating. And I just wondered,
because they're less expensive than the nice, beautiful, organic stuff.
Yeah, and then there's also plenty of issues about distribution. There are plenty of people who live in neighborhoods where they can't even get fresh fruits and vegetables. And so I haven't read the new book, but I wondered if, Mark, if you could comment on the what you're saying in light of the economic downturn and in light of people's different economic circumstances as well.
Well, the silver lining in the economic downturn may be that people start cooking again, or there is the possibility that people just give up and eat Cheetos all day long. I'm obviously advocating for the former, and I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. I do think that if people weigh the benefits of cooking for themselves as opposed to eating more junk, they would choose that path. As for people who live in supermarket ghettos or outside the food sheds or whatever kind of trendy term you want to put in this, it's a tough question. There is some movement on the part of supermarkets to say, smaller supermarket chains, to say that for every supermarket they build in a suburb, they're going to try to build one in the inner city, which would be a nice thing to see. But I want to just argue briefly that if you can get your hands on food, even pantry food, not necessarily fresh food, but even rice and beans and the occasional head of lettuce, you are talking about a per-serving cost that's lower than even the cheapest processed food. So if, you know, four cheeseburgers cost $4 or $6 or whatever, you can buy a lot of pantry staples for $6 and extend them much, much further than you can the processed junk. the problem really comes with what happens when people can't get access to fresh food, and I have no answer for that. It's you know, it's tragic, but it exists, and it's something that needs to be addressed.
Give us a little more sense, if you would, Mark, of how those pantry staples flow into food that you, as a food guy, want to eat. I mean, how do you keep it rolling? A lot of Americans just don't have a steady cooking habit, even.
Yeah.
And, so how does it work?
Well, I find myself, and I think many of my friends who like cooking but really say that they don't have enough time to cook every day find themselves doing the same thing. I find myself, when I pull out a pound of beans to cook, even though I know I'm going to eat a quarter of that pound, I cook the whole pound, and then I either freeze some or refrigerate some, and then it's there for the rest of the week. And the same with brown rice or the hippy-dippy quinoa or wheat berries or any of the other whole grains. You can cook a lot at once, and they do then freeze or refrigerate perfectly. So that's one way to get ahead of the game. The other thing is, the other day I found myself with, I don't know, 5 or 6 vegetables that were on the verge of not being that desirable anymore. So I cooked them all at once and just parceled them out over the course of the next few meals. I mean, cooking is a way to preserve food. So if you have food in the refrigerator that seems like, you know, 2 days from now I'm going to have to throw this out, cook it, and it extends its life another few days. So, you know, a lot of this is kind of experience. It's being comfortable in the kitchen. It's understanding what it takes to stock a pantry. And that those are issues that I've addressed in my cookbooks for you know, mm-hmm. 15, 20 years. I think what's different about what I'm doing now is not so much that it's saying – or let me start that sentence again. What I like about what I'm doing now is that it's very much in tune with what I've been doing all along, because ultimately the answer remains – have control over what you put in your mouth. Go shopping, put the food in your refrigerator, and then eat it raw or cook it or whatever it takes, but make sure you know what you're eating. And if you do that, then a diet like the ones described in Food Matters becomes easy to follow, and your food life becomes much more under your control. And I'm not saying this is something that people can adjust. It's very easy to talk to callers and when I go out and talk to people, when people already cook, they get this and they can see how easy it is. When people don't, there is the same conversion that I've been preaching for 20 years that people have to go through, which is that buy a cookbook, buy some food, look up some recipes for things you want to cook and
right.
cook them. And you will see that it's, you know, it's easy and it's rewarding, but it's a craft. It has to be learned. It's not necessarily intuitive.
Let's get one more call here from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Melinda. Hi, Melinda. You're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been largely vegan for 22 years, and it is the best thing I've ever done for myself, physically, spiritually, emotionally. I feel great. I'm like 44 years old, and I just got carded the other day for buying a bottle of red wine.
good for you. So what about vegan till 6? Does that sound good to you or like sacrilege, Melinda?
Vegan what?
Vegan till 6 p.m. That's Mark's new mantra here.
I'm vegan 24/7. And in today's economy, it's so much easier to do rice and beans and whole wheat pasta with tomato sauce because those are cheap staples.
It sounds like it's working for you, Melinda. Thanks very much for calling. And Mark, I've got another question here off our website. To your sort of food guru self, asking, do you enjoy dining out? Or when when you think something could be done better, do you have the urge to write a note to the chef suggesting a different technique? This is for cookbook master Mark Bittman, I guess.
I love that question because when I started writing about food, it was 1980, yeah. And I was doing restaurant reviews in New Haven, and there weren't that many good restaurants. I mean, there were a few. But I soon found myself saying, here's what this chef wants to do, and here's how you can do it better at home. And so I never really wrote the notes to the chefs. I wrote the notes to the readers. And the notes, even at the beginning of my food writing career, were, you want pasta with pesto? Here's how you make pasta. Here's how you make pesto. Now you have pasta with pesto. You just saved yourself $15 and you probably made it better anyway. And I'd still say that. I do go out to eat, but it's largely either for social purposes or to have food that I haven't had before. But I'm often frustrated. I'm often annoyed. And that never happens when I cook at home. I'm almost always pleased with what happens at home socially and culinarily.
And you know, we've just got a minute here, but there's another interesting point you make for a food guy about hunger and saying Americans are just too unfamiliar with a little bit of hunger. You say, you know, you don't have sex every time you think about sex. You don't go to sleep every time you feel a little tired. There's no need to eat every time you feel a little hungry. You're kind of inviting a little bit of hunger to the table as well.
Well, who doesn't say, I need a nap every afternoon at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock? I mean, that varies. But every individual thinks they need a nap in the afternoon, and no one takes one. Yet, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when they get hungry, they rush off and have a Snickers bar or, you know, whatever. I'm just saying you can probably make it from 4 o'clock till 6 or 7 on a handful of nuts or a bag of popcorn or an apple or two apples, for that matter. You don't need to have a slice of pizza, a Snickers bar, or both. So, yeah, hunger is just as acceptable as tiredness or anything else.
A word to the wise from the great guy in the kitchen. Mark Bittman, it's been wonderful having you with us. The new book is Food Matters, A Guide to Conscious Eating. Mark, thanks so much. Come again.
Thanks a million, Tom. A lot of fun.
A lot of fun here as well. Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.